living ideas.
You need it. You will use it.
Helping us manage the land and the wildlife we share this land with.
Look at your children. Look at the future.
Hi, I'm Brenda Moyo, and we look at some of the benefits we can enjoy if we're careful about using the resources around us. These young voices belong to pupils at Chibuluma Basic School in the Mumba district of Zambia. The occasion is the opening of a new classroom block for the school. In the song, the pupils sing praises for their local chief Chibuluma, after whom the school is named. Chief Chibuluma heads a small group in the area which the government allows to control some of the wild animals around the community. The new classroom block is yet another project made possible by the activities of the chief's group or committee, as some people call it. The new classroom block has been built with money from what is called the Wildlife Conservation Revolving Fund. A revolving fund just means that money is constantly put into the account so that the community can keep spending from the account. In Zambia, a number of schools, clinics, teachers' houses and chiefs' palaces have been built or renovated from the money in the Wildlife Revolving Fund. The money comes from a project called AdMed. AdMed involves people in the protection of wildlife in their areas. This protection is called conservation. Dr. Saiwana heads the AdMed project in Zambia.
What it entails here is that the local communities are not doing this conservation for nothing. They are conserving wildlife with a view to get direct benefits from the utilization of wildlife resources in their various game management areas. This is done through the administrative management design for game management areas, and this is what is called, in short, AdMed program.
It is important to remember that conservation means protection. Chairman of the Mumba Game Management Authority, Mr. Roy Shichilaba, explains why the AdMed program has been so popular with local people.
People are seeing what is supposed to be for their benefit in this new arrangement, because as of now, we are talking of schools having been built from this same arrangement. We are talking of grinding mills having been made available to these people. We're talking of many more other, you know, facilities being made available because of this same arrangement.
Garth Owen Smith is the co-director of an organization in Namibia called Integrated Development Rural and Nature Conservation.
Maybe the first thing that one should recognize is that rural African communities, particularly in the more remote areas, have lived with wildlife in the past. It's part of their culture, their traditions, what they pass on to the next generation. The support from the community at large has been remarkable. I'm sure it was in them all the time. They just didn't have a way of putting it into practice.
This song from Botswana is an example of how closely the communities lived with the animals. It warns hunters to be careful when they go out because there are people amongst the animals. Mr. Garth Owen Smith explains one very common way for traditional societies to protect the wildlife.
There were, in all African societies, either religious or social taboos with regard to the hunting or killing of a range of species. And again here, these acted towards protecting those species.
Usually the sacred and other protected animals were used for family or clan names. The family did not kill such animals. These are what we know today as totems. It was a way of showing respect for the life around us. Mr. Takadu is a game warden in the area of Maun in Botswana. He is very interested in traditional conservation and once spoke to a headman about the use of totems.
He said, you know, it was more or less resource allocation, that certain people would go for this animal, certain people not eat this animal, and whatever. It was the way they somehow indigenously allocate resources. Because if they were just going for one animal, there was that danger of depletion, even though by then they were in abundance.
The chief usually associated himself with particular animals that were considered sacred, and these animals provided him with special meat. Mr. Lax Masumba, the chief's assistant at Kavimba, also in Botswana, tells us which animals these were.
Some of the animals which were conserved were like the big reptiles, such as crocodiles, and the biggest animal, the strongest one, the elephant. Those were killed for the purpose of feasting or merrymaking through the orders of the chief. The whole meat of the elephant was not eaten by his people. The chief could just only go for the trunk.
Spiritual beliefs or respect for ancestral spirits and chiefs also protected mountains, forests, trees and herbs. But few people today recognize how good our forefathers were at conserving their environment. The Botswana, like other Africans, did not disregard their wildlife as is now commonly believed. Uleka Itakatu of the Wildlife Department in Botswana gives us an example of how the traditional knowledge was documented and passed on.
The tribal authorities, they had the strength enough and the jaws and the teeth to bite in case there's any irregularity. Even though the regulations for hunting by then were not documented, but they were there. No one could go and hunt without seeing the eldest person within maybe a regiment. In African culture, more especially here in Botswana, there were these different age regiments where men and women were grouped according to their ages, and they were taught certain things. And so more especially on the section of men, they were taught some hunting ethics and conservation ethics, that if you go to hunt, you do this and you do this. There's always a leader, you tell this person. But it's like when the contemporary approaches came, it was like in African culture, there was just chaos. Anyone can do whatever he likes anytime.
Another example of an important traditional institution is the gathering of families called the lineages at the sacred fire of the Himba people in Namibia.
A group of lineages will traditionally live together and share a land, and they will use that region extremely wisely. Any major decision that a Himba lineage makes has to be discussed at the sacred fire, or if it's really important, at the ancestors' graves, by the lineages that are involved. And this is not a quaint traditional rite that's old-fashioned and outdated. It's a very practical, robust mechanism that, which facilitates environmental planning. A group of stock owners get together in a period of stress, drought, for example, and they will decide where to take their stock, how to share this environment sustainably. Similarly, the sacred fire is a place where local knowledge is passed on to a younger generation.
Sustainability is also very important for our resources. One group in the Caprivi in Namibia came up with an interesting way to make their culture sustainable. The elders were worried that the youngsters were moving away and the traditions of the group would die out. Maxi Lewis of the Namibia Community-Based Tourism Association explains what they did.
That's when they came up with the idea of setting up a traditional village. They have the routines, like their cultural routines within this village where people are being employed. And I think that's also a way of managing your culture. But on the other hand, you're also transferring those skills to other members of the society, which is the kids and so on.
But there is one very big difference between the world our ancestors lived in and the one we live in today. Garth Owen-Smith, also from Namibia, explains.
You know, conservation is a new development. It's a new development because for once, over the last 50 or 60 years, human beings have had the capacity to wipe out wildlife. Rural African communities had to live with wildlife. They didn't have the means to wipe them out. So they didn't have to apply the same intervention techniques that we today have to do to protect the remaining wildlife here in Africa. A lot of the traditional conservation practices were very subtle.
This means that people from outside did not understand what the community was doing very easily, but these communities probably would not have survived if they did not know how to use their resources wisely. But now this traditional knowledge is in danger of being lost. Dr. Jacobson, also from Namibia, explains why.
The authority structures in these societies is breaking down as children are going to school. Major new influences are coming in, new aspirations. I think if we could somehow change the education system, the system is so Eurocentric, and people are not looking at what's going on the ground and taking the best of indigenous traditional practices and mixing that with the best of modern ecological practices.
We all know that things changed when the colonizers arrived. They moved some communities away from their land and eventually stopped many from hunting. This created a lot of problems. One example is the Mahenya district of Zimbabwe, where the colonial government created the Gonarezhou National Park. Mr. Lyson Masango is the deputy headmaster at the local district school.
Yeah, it was extremely bad. In fact, we were at war with national parks, because national parks officials used to come here during the night with guns and then arrest people, torture them, beat them, and also they had to move from home to home in search of poachers. Whoever was found nearby was handcuffed and then was forced to reveal where the poachers were. It was not good, in fact.
Even the language changed. People who hunt were now called poachers. The local communities had absolutely no control over the land. Moses Nasilele is director of the Namibian Community-Based Tourism Association and the Caprivi Arts Center in Namibia. He thinks that what happened to many of us during the colonial period was a robbery. As a result, he says it is very important to give the communities access again to the land.
To me, I find that's fine, you know, to when the people are empowered, when the people have their sense of being, you know, and they have this ownership they feel, and that makes them great, you know, because they have this dignity, you know. And unlike a situation where a man is robbed out of his, you know, resources around, so it's partly empowerment.
In Namibia, commercial farmers were given a certain amount of ownership and it has helped them.
Since 1975, the farmers on privately owned farmland have had conditional rights over their wildlife, which has enabled them to build up a not inconsiderable industry today. In communal areas in Namibia, they have never had these rights, not since the colonial period started.
It is clear that what communities need is a similar chance. In Botswana, they got it. This music comes from the village of Sankunyo in Botswana. In this country, government took an active role since the middle of the 1970s when communities were given some land to raise livestock. The policy was improved 11 years later to include wildlife. Mr. Takadu, a game warden at Maun in Botswana, tells us how policies continued to change.
In 1986, there was the wildlife conservation policy which the government of Botswana came up with, and this defined those areas termed marginal to livestock industry by the Tribal Grazing Land Policy of 1975 as wildlife management areas. Then out of those areas termed wildlife management areas, the very same policy advocated for community participation.
Getting support from our governments then is very important. In Zimbabwe, it appears that a lack of support from some government agencies has become a problem. Mr. Nick Okono is an advisor to the Guruwe Rural District Council on Natural Resources Management. He was instrumental in the setting up of the Campfire program in the area. Campfire is an initiative that tries to increase the role of local communities in natural resources management so that they may have the benefits of the resources. In this interview, he shares with us his frustrations at what he sees as government's reluctance to allow greater community participation in the management of wildlife.
We've got a problem with government. Specifically National Parks, or the new acting director, I'm not sure that he is totally in favour of Campfire. I think, and this is my personal view, I think he sees it as basically a lessening of his power as director. In other words, he's now given some of his power to the community, and from what I've seen recently, I'm not so sure that the new National Park team are very keen on Campfire. Either government must step in and help, or they should actually stop the Campfire program.
Sharing authority is not easy, but the price that governments pay for not involving the communities can be very high.
It was just very terrible that one she's a game guard. And it was just an obstacle of saying that this man has come to arrest them or to do that. Because the government has taken too much powers and to overloaded itself to look all the past patient and all the animals by itself without involving the people who are there. And these people didn't feel that they should protect the animals because they thought it was just government animals, and by them they didn't enjoy anything.
That was Chief Chibuluma of Zambia. It is very common all across the region that where efforts are made to include the community in managing the animals, there is less hunting. Chief Chisunga is from Mashonaland East Province, a district called Guruve in Zimbabwe. Any National Parks and Wildlife Officer would be pleased with the story he has to tell.
In the past, the killing of wild animals and poaching was very common. But when campfire came, we realized that we could benefit a lot from the wildlife. Proceeds from wildlife have been channeled into developmental projects like building of schools and clinics.
In the case of Zambia, the ADMED program has so much support from the community that it has created a problem. The wildlife management areas keep getting bigger and more people are attracted to these areas. So now communities find themselves having to deal with illegal settlers. Dr. Saiwana, the Director of Wildlife and National Parks, shares with us some of the local chief's views about the illegal settlers.
Of course, the population in this country also is growing. As it is growing, we are now seeing a problem where now people are encroaching the prime habitat for wildlife. But because of the support the Department of National Parks and Wildlife Service is getting from the local communities, the traditional rulers, the chiefs, are saying these people who are illegal settlers in our game management areas should actually be repatriated and given other settlements.
This is also a problem in Botswana. People who left for the city in search of employment are now beginning to come back. A headman explains how the local wildlife committee there is dealing with the situation.
For someone to be a member of the community trust, we have constituted that person, if he is new in this area, should stay up to a period of 5 years before he or she can be taken to be a member of the Sankuyu Community Management Trust.
It is problems like these which the new laws in Namibia are hoping to avoid.
Namibia was the last country to got its independence within the African continent. I think we also learn a lot from what has been happening in other countries. And I think then we have taken another direction.
That was Maxi Lewis from the Namibia Community-Based Tourism Association, or NACOBTA, as the organization is often called.
We decided to address communities first. To actually, and that's why the concept of conservancy is coming in and the concept of communities looking after their own natural resources.
As Maxi says, the key to resource management in Namibia is the conservancies. Mr. Garth Owen-Smith is co-director of Integrated Rural Development and Nature Conservation. He explains exactly what conservancies are.
And enabled the communities to basically share the same rights that farmers on private land have had for 20 years. The rights that they have are conditional. The government still plays a role, which would vary depending on the type of wildlife. Clearly endangered species, black rhino and elephant, are still highly protected, and communities will not have any direct rights over these species if they occur in the communal areas.
Benny Roman of an area in Namibia called Ward 11 says the benefits will be a good thing for the communities.
Farming in this area is not good enough to get enough economical income for our living, because this area is it's a semi-desert area and you can't count alone on farming in this area. The problem here was that communities haven't seen the value of wildlife because they haven't any access to it, and income from those things were only for outsiders, maybe say big lodge owners or goes to the central government. They didn't see the need of protecting those things.
And how did the communities get this law passed? Mr. Owen-Smith explains.
There was support from the NGOs and of course from the communities as well. But without those progressive thinking government officials, it would have probably taken us even longer.
But some people in Namibia believe that there is still a lot more thinking that needs to go into the conservancy law. Moses Nasilele again from Nakobta.
Like where I come from in Kaprivi, there's a problem of people are living in two different places. There's the winter where they stay during rain season, and there's some place where they stay when it's dry. So if you control them to give them one part, then it means they will not have access to other part of the land. So that already it's going to be a problem. And to me, I think it should be controlled by the traditional people, the traditional kutas, together with the community.
Changes cannot be dictated, but must be accepted by people on the ground. The involvement of chiefs or traditional leaders seems to be the first important step towards positive participation of communities in sustainable management of natural resources. Moses Nasilele, who works with the Kaprivi Art Center in Namibia, says all the artists in his group realize how important it is to do this.
Dissemination of information is not enough if you give it to our group. But if we use our group and also the decision makers like the traditional headmen together, then we think that it will be effective to some extent because they've got in contact with the people. But today we find the one who controls the whole system stays in Windhoek, for instance. And this is the guy who actually authorizes the use of the land where he has not even been, bypassing all these people.
That Owen Smith from Namibia talks about some of the things that the Namibians have tried to avoid.
I think from contact that we had with Zimbabweans, both within government service and within NGOs, one of the disadvantages that they told us about in the campfire legislation was that the devolution didn't go down far enough into the communities, that it went down to regional level and not further. They felt this was a disadvantage because it kept a lot of the responsibility in the hands of the regional authority, who didn't have the power to actually enforce it. It was the local communities who were actually on the ground with the wildlife. And there was also, I think just through bureaucracy, there was often delays in the money getting from the regional councils down to the district or ward, and they certainly recommended that we should take it down as far as we could to the local communities.
And how successful have these changes been for the communities? Mr. Okono is an advisor to the Wildlife Council in Guruve District in Zimbabwe, and although he has doubts about the willingness of central authorities to cede more power to the grassroots, he is encouraged by what is happening on the ground.
The people are becoming more and more knowledgeable and more aware of the problems and are sorting them out. Yes, it's a self-evaluating process and it's a self-learning. The biggest or the fastest way of learning in my mind has been the distribution of dividends.
So it is not only the acknowledgement of traditional wisdom and the restoration of legal rights which makes people aware of the need to manage their natural resources properly. It is, above all, the material benefit they get out of it. Let us move to Botswana.
As far as I'm concerned, I've realized that the Department of Wildlife and National Parks have taken a very good step. When this area was closed from hunting, it was of no benefit to the community. Today it is much, much better because we are able to derive some benefits, like we consume meat locally, which is taken from our area. Even the money that we have presently, which we took from the safari operator, there's just nothing that we are worrying about within the area. Things are just okay.
Baiti Kozana is an old man. He is head of the Sankunyu community just over an hour's drive from Maun in Botswana. The safari operator he refers to and who is paying the money to this community is a rather young man, and he is white. How did this relationship come about?
I was basically brought up in Botswana. I was hunting professionally for nearly 15 years. And I decided at the end of last year that I would like to start my own operation. And I think this area particularly was the second area to come onto tender on a community joint venture basis.
That is Chris Collins. Once the Sankunyu community got the right to look for a business partner of their choice, they put out a tender. A tender is an invitation to propose a way to conduct a business. Out of 10 competitors, Chris Collins came out on top. And although more experienced companies were available, the community chose someone new in the hope that he would move from the old ways which had sidelined the community. The partners signed a one-year contract in which the safari operator promised a couple of things.
We agreed to employ a certain amount of people from the village. We agreed to certain things that they stipulated. One of the things that they wanted was they wanted 50% of the meat that was shot in a hunting operation, and also a certain amount of money to pay for the area. Altogether, it was 285,000 pula.
It is easy to understand why Baidi Gozana says things are just okay. Chris Collins talks about what they will do in future.
We intend taking on an apprentice professional hunter for next year, because as they have the area for 15 years of community, they need to have people trained in those skills and have to start now. Because within, it's going to take 4 or 5 years before someone has reached the stage where they'll be able to take out a client to hunt professionally.
While this project is giving immediate material benefits, training in various skills will not only empower this community, but will ensure that the benefits to the community will be sustainable.
Save, 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 save,